Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the program, we've got Rob Bishop's Public Lands Initiative. Chris Stewart tries to exempt parts of Utah from national monument designations. Also, cancer-causing air toxins, movement by lawmakers toward blocking a regional power grid, accusations of sexual assault levied against a local fire chief, and what happened during the special session of the state legislature. Joining me in the studio this morning, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson is with us. Good morning, Lee.
Good morning.
Environment reporter Emma Penrod joins us also. Good morning, Emma.
Good morning.
Also, government reporter Christopher Smart is here in studio as well. Thanks for being here, Chris.
Hi, how's it going?
Very well, thank you. And joining us via the phone from Washington is Salt Lake Tribune Washington correspondent Thomas Burr. Welcome, Thomas.
Hey, thanks, Roger.
And listeners, you can join this conversation as well. Put your comments and questions in the comment section at sltrib.com or call us up at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Some national coverage that we were expecting to see break at some point today was that Donald Trump was set to reveal his running mate, but he has delayed that announcement, citing the terror attack in Nice, France, which is where much of the coverage of today's news is focused. And of course, you'll continue to hear that coverage here on KCPW and on Utah Public Radio. But Thomas Burr, before we turn to other stories of the day, signs had been pointing to Trump's running mate being Indiana Governor Mike Pence. But after postponing the announcement, he made some statements that leave his VP pick, I guess, still kind of in question. Is that right?
Well, things changed rather dramatically and quickly. Actually, Trump just tweeted probably 10 minutes ago that he's picked Pence as his running mate. So, yes, there was some idle speculation that this was maybe he'll change his mind, but he made it official this morning. So despite him, I'm waiting because of the attacks in Nice. He actually just tweeted about it just okay. A little bit ago.
Okay, so some breaking news that he is actually going with Indiana Governor Mike Pence. What do we know about Pence, Tommy?
You know, it's an interesting pick. Obviously, Trump comes from outside the political realm in some ways. He never held elected office before. In fact, he's switched back and forth between being a Democrat and Republican and donated to both parties. So in this case, he's picking somebody who has a little bit more of a political career. Mike Pence was a member of Congress for a while. He's obviously now the governor of Indiana. So he's trying to look for themes here, somebody who has those political skills, somebody who's not necessarily establishment, but is an elected, somebody who has been elected to office before. They do line up in many ways along the same, you know, lines when it comes to the social issues. Obviously, Newt Gingrich was considered as well as Chris Christie and a few others on that kind of short list. But right now it's Trump and Pence.
All right, Trump and Pence. Well, the Republican convention begins on Monday, and there was talk for a time. Tommy, of the GOP convention being contested, and that we might potentially see someone other than Trump come out of the nominating process as the GOP's leader. That doesn't appear to be something that is going to happen anymore. Correct?
Yeah, in fact, that was quashed yesterday. So the attempts by some people on the Rules Committee to allow like a conscience exception for people to vote as they see fit did come up, but there was kind of like some backroom dealing, and they didn't have enough support to actually bring it forward, nor did they have support to bring forward something called a minority report, which would allow them to actually have votes on issues instead of just kind of as people are bound to vote for a certain thing. So, this is Trump's nomination, and it's not going to be contested. That doesn't mean, however, that the convention won't be a little bit of mayhem, given there are a lot of people, including a lot of the Utah Republican delegates, who are not happy about Trump as the nominee.
Well, it's and that actually leads into another story that I think is kind of interesting, a story that you reported on this week, a comparison between Donald Trump and former GOP contender and Utah favorite Mitt Romney, especially when it comes to a specific group of voters, there being kind of a divide between Romney and Trump in favor of Trump.
Yeah, this is actually really interesting. So Pew Research Center came out with a poll this week that showed that despite all these concerns early on, would evangelical voters go for Trump? Evangelical voters, especially just white evangelical voters, are a key voting block for Republicans. And the question was, would they go for somebody who says things like 2 Corinthians instead of 2 Corinthians and has not really been known as a very religious person, and in fact was kind of touted by as a playboy for a while. But it actually turns out that they are going for him strongly, and in fact stronger at this moment than they were going for Mitt Romney the same point 4 years ago. It's not too much of a difference, 78% for Trump at this point, 75% for Mitt Romney at this point in 2012. But it's still significant, and it shows a little bit of maybe that hesitancy that's still out there or was out there with evangelicals supporting or not supporting a Mormon candidate in Mitt Romney. Of course, Mitt Romney won the same percentage in 2012 of the evangelical that John McCain won in 2008, but he got fewer votes because fewer evangelicals voted.
Okay, so it's conceivably as much a commentary on evangelical attitudes towards Mormons as it is on their attitudes towards Donald Trump. But he does seem to have support, despite, as you said, some qualms that evangelicals might have with him.
Yeah, let me just boil this down. You have an R behind your name and you're running for president. Good chance you're going to get the evangelical vote.
All right. Okay, well, I guess bodes well for Trump in November, but, time will tell. In other news, Thomas, Representative Chris Stewart there in Washington took aim at President Obama's ability to declare national monuments in a big chunk of Utah. Tell us about this strategy here and what Chris Stewart did on Wednesday, I guess it was.
So this has been attempted before, and the House passed this measure. It was part of the Interior Appropriations Bill. Chris Stewart had inserted some language in there. And it doesn't necessarily say that the president cannot name a new monument. The president still has the power under the Antiquities Act to name a new national monument wherever, essentially. He can find a justification to do so. But it restricts any money going towards that creation. So Obama could say, I want to designate Bear's Ears, and just go over to pass the law. You can say that, but they can do anything to actually make it happen. Chris Stewart sits in the Appropriations Committee, and he's using his ability as an appropriator in Congress to say, okay, there's money there, but you can't use it for this specific purpose. Now, of course, the White House has issued a veto threat on this bill,
right?
Because of the monument language, but because of a host of other things as well.
Is it a veto threat on the entire bill, which is, I think, a funding measure, or is it line item specific vetoes that he'll go through?
The president doesn't have a line item veto, so it's a veto of the entire bill. But let's just face it, it's not going to get through the Senate either. So, the Senate has enough Democrats that can block something like this. And what usually happens in these cases is the House passes a bill with a bunch of, messaging language in there and what Democrats would term poison pills. They don't get it out of the Senate. When Interior is about to run out of money or the government's about to run out of money, we pass the continuing resolution and they just keep funding it at the last level they had.
Okay.
Well, that's how this town works.
Funding in Washington. The timing on this bill is also kind of interesting in that Interior Secretary Sally Jewell is here in Utah right now on a tour of the Bears Ears region, site of a potential national monument. Was that part of the point of this language being inserted into this bill?
I think that there's definitely a reason for that being inserted because of the concern about whether the president would name Bears Ears. But it's probably just coincidental that the secretary happened to be in Utah at the same time. This bill came up right now, and she happens to be there. But it's not because she's there; it's because of this big concern of the president trying to do another monument.
Okay. Well, on the public lands front, Representative Rob Bishop, along with Representative Jason Chaffetz, unveiled a long-awaited package of bills yesterday, the Public Lands Initiative, and it was almost immediately, I guess, divisive. Is that the fair assumption?
Yeah, if I can just catch everyone up, I think most of your listeners know about this, but the Public Lands Initiative is this three-year-long process where Rob Bishop and Jason Chaffetz, two Utah Republicans, try to bring in all the stakeholders, environmentalists, developers, cattlemen, county commissioners, everyone with interest in what to do with public lands in Utah, and try to come up with some kind of compromise legislation. Now, environmental groups praised the process, that there was a good idea to try to do this, but they almost universally said that the resulting bill, the resulting legislation has a couple of poison pills, doesn't go far enough, and that they really felt several tribal groups felt left out of the process, ignored in some form. So this is legislation, though, and the House is controlled by Republicans, so they're going to have hearings, and they'll probably pass it out of committee, maybe even pass it out of the House this year.
I want to remind our listeners that they can join this conversation. Call us up with your comments, 801-355-TALK, or you can put a comment at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. And you were listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW. We talked about the timing of the Secretary, Interior Secretary Sally Jewell being here. Was the timing of the unveiling of this public lands initiative a little bit strange? Congress is now left for recess. And does that say anything about the possibility of this bill, passing?
Well, so Congressman Bishop had unveiled a draft of this bill in January. And then since has been always, every time I asked him, when's it coming? When's it coming? When's the final thing coming? And he said, soon, soon. Every time it was soon. He needed to get this bill out before Congress adjourned. They went back until September. So literally it was unveiled about 4 hours before Congress left town. There may be some stuff they can do in between, but he at least wanted to get the ball rolling. But legislation introduced this late in the game is a little difficult to get through both chambers.
Right. Okay. So, you laid out some of the, the responses, but what would this new proposal, the proposal that he unveiled the day before yesterday, what would it actually do?
So it would create a Bears Ears area. So it would preserve the Bears Ears area. I think 1.4 million acres, which is about 500,000 acres less than what a lot of environmental groups and tribal leaders wanted to do. It also creates a new Jurassic National Park, which is different than Jurassic Park. Just want to make that clear. There are no real dinosaurs at this one. But it will expand Arches National Park by about 20,000 acres. It creates some other areas that are preserved. But it also releases about 80,000 acres of wilderness for what could be mineral development. It does some switching around to allow the state lands to kind of consolidate what lands it has in the area. There are several parts of it. Also, a companion piece, I should note, that they're going to introduce with this bill would bar the president from using that Antiquities Act to name a national monument in a big swath of Utah.
That's a companion bill. That's an interesting this is a proposal that would say you are prohibited from naming it. This is the bill that we kind of discussed earlier. Is that correct? By Chris Stewart?
It's a little different. So Chris Stewart's would stop any money from being used to create monuments. This bill would actually just say the president can't create monuments in these areas of Utah.
Well, it's interesting stuff, and I know that there's a lot that you have to get done before you head off to the convention in Cleveland, but Washington correspondent Thomas Burr with the Salt Lake Tribune, we need to let you go. So thanks very much for your time this morning.
Thanks, Roger.
And we're going to have to take our first break, but when we come back, we'll turn to some stories that came out during this week's special session of state lawmakers. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW in the Greater Salt Lake Valley and throughout the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines, the Salt Lake Tribune Reporter News Roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough, joined for the rest of the hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Lee Davidson, Emma Penrod, and Christopher Smart, and we are digging into this past week's news in review. Again, you can join the conversation commenting at the Behind the Headlines page, currently live at sltrib.com, or calling us at 801-355-8255. I want to turn to the special session of the state legislature. I want to make a quick correction, though, before I move forward. At the top of the hour, I said that there were accusations of sexual assault against a fire chief in Utah. It's actually sexual harassment accusations. Just a correction there really quickly. Lee Davidson, on Wednesday, there was a special session of the Utah State Legislature, and they meant to tackle, a few pending items that weren't resolved in their general session earlier this year. What was on the agenda for this special session, or what did they tackle?
Well, there were nine bills. Eight of them passed, but three of them were major. One involved drones around wildfires. They passed a bill that allows shooting them down or neutralizing them, and also increases penalties for pilots who have drones in those areas, and includes perhaps making them pay for any damages they do, which can be a lot. It can be millions of dollars. Also, they passed a bill to offer tax breaks for data centers of big companies like Facebook. Facebook apparently is considering moving a data center here. And they also passed a bill to funnel $10 million towards a new $17 million arena at the State Fair Park.
Okay. So an overture to Facebook, a measure to down drones, and then this Fair Park Stadium were the major projects of the day. Let's take a look at each of those maybe individually. You said that lawmakers are courting Facebook. They're trying to invite Facebook. This looks like an overture to Facebook. What was going on with this bill? This is a tax break, a tax incentive for big companies to move in. How much money are we talking about, and what would it give to a company like Facebook?
Not sure how much we're talking about, but it's a major tax break that they wouldn't have to pay taxes on what they would have had in the future. The problem is we don't know how much that is. But lawmakers say getting them here and the jobs it would create and the construction it would create is worth it. And we would have not had the taxes they would have paid anyway if they didn't come here.
You know, we already have the National Security Agency data center in Bluffdale, where there have been concerns over things like the amount of water being used to cool the facility. Was there, I guess the question I'm getting to is, was there any opposition to this bill?
In short, no. Okay. It flew through with very little comment and very little opposition.
Okay. Well, and then there was funding set aside for a stadium at the Utah State Fair Park. How much money was set aside, and what will it build?
$10 million in state money. It's for a $17 million new arena at the Fair Park that would do many things, include host the Days of 47 Rodeo in the future. They want to build it very quickly. They want it done by next July. Next July, the Vivint Smart Home Arena downtown where the Utah Jazz plays will be under renovation, so the rodeo could not be held there. There was a little bit of controversy because the bill also exempts normal procurement procedure, so that they can do quick but still competitive bidding. There was some concern raised over why they were doing that. Sandra Hollins, who's a Democrat who represents the area around the Fair Park, said, well, we just need to build this fast, and we have some private donations. The LDS Church is kicking in $3 million, and everyone wants it built fast, and this is the only way to get it done on time.
Well, you said quick but still competitive. What kind of procurement changes have been made that would allow or that people are concerned about, I guess?
Their concern, anytime you say exempt from normal procurement procedures, they're concerned. And there wasn't a lot of explanation about exactly what would happen, except that normal procurement procedure requires a certain amount of time for things to be bid, a certain amount of time for review, and they want it much quicker than that. They want things to get going soon.
And when we say procurement procedure, we're talking about construction bidding, contracts going out for the building of this. You said $10 million and then $17 million from the state, $17 million to build. You just mentioned that $3 million is coming, I guess, from the LDS Church?
Right, and some money from Salt Lake City, Salt Lake County, and some private donation.
Okay. Well, and so this is going to play host to at least the Days of 47 Rodeo. Do they have other ideas of what might happen there?
I think maybe more music concerts, maybe horse shows, other similar things.
Okay. And then also, as you mentioned at the beginning, lawmakers are worried about drones, specifically because of some recent events having to do with drones getting in the way of efforts to fight wildfires. The language of the bill was interesting. It was talking about neutralizing drones in the area of wildfires. And I guess that means, as you said, shooting them down?
Or jamming them electronically, whatever it takes to knock them down. The large Saddle Fire in southwestern Utah has had numerous incidents over the last couple of weeks where air tankers have been grounded because of drones in the area. And the legislature earlier this year passed another law outlawing flying drones around wildfires, and it set some pretty significant punishments also. That law's only been in effect 2 or 3 months, but they've had enough problems that they wanted to do this to draw more attention to the problem. and to beef up penalties even more.
And Lee Davidson, the drone around the Saddle Fire in southeastern Utah is that people have been seeing. I don't know if it's one or multiples, but these are most likely privately operated cameras that people are flying over the area, I guess?
Right. They haven't caught the people doing it yet. They think it's people who just have curiosity and are flying these things. But it causes problems, including if an air tanker is full of retardant and they are called out of the area, it can't land because they're too heavy, so they have to dump the retardant somewhere. Don Ibsen, a Republican from St. George who sponsored the bill, said, you know, it's costing up to millions of dollars. And this new bill would allow catching people and making them pay for such things, including damage done by the fire that perhaps enlarged because they couldn't fight it.
Wow. Okay. So, additional consequences of the growth of the fire. Drone operators beware out there. You know, these are measures that passed during this recent special session. Is the governor expected to sign all of these bills?
Yeah. When he issued the call to bring the legislature into special session, he essentially favored all of these bills. And he put out statements essentially saying why they were all needed. So, yes, he's expected to sign all of them.
One measure that didn't make it out of the special session was one that we saw previously having to do with visitation rights. What is it that this bill would have done, and it's one that didn't pass?
It gets a little complicated, but it would allow grandparents to sue in court for rights to visit grandchildren who have been adopted by another family member. It went down in the House. There were two major concerns. Many members felt that the adopted parent should be the one deciding who should be able to visit their child and what's healthy and not a court. And there's a concern that some parents who have lost their parental rights live with the grandparents. And so if they allow grandparents to visit, they're essentially allowing this parent with terminated rights back into the life of the child. And so those two major concerns killed the bill.
Okay. Well, Lee Davidson, thanks for this roundup of what happened at the special session of lawmakers. Lots of legislative coverage by Lee and others at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Check it out there. And listeners, again, you are invited to join this conversation. The number to call, 801-355-8255. You can comment also at sltrib.com. Emma Penrod, environment reporter. During this past special legislative session, some lawmakers were mulling over the possibility of Utah participating in a regional electrical grid. And before we get into what the lawmakers were doing, maybe tell us what the basic idea of this regional grid is.
Okay, so the basic idea, California has a nonprofit independent organization that was set up by their legislature to operate parts of its grid called the Independent System Operator, or the CAISO, the California Independent System Operator. They have a surplus of solar power because their state is pushing very hard to get renewable energy on board, but you still need fossil fuels to fill in the gaps when, you know, they use mostly natural gas when, you know, the solar power is not generating because the sun's not out.
Right.
And so, but at the same time, during the midday, they're not using enough power to use all of the solar power they're generating. Right now, you have to use power basically the second it's generated. So California just turns the panels off. They don't want to keep doing that. And so they have proposed to create to basically expand their organization and to manage the electrical grids for 11 Western states, including Utah. The goal here being they could sell their solar power outside very easily. They could just send it over this grid and somebody else could sell them wind power or hydropower when the sun's not shining.
Sort of an efficiency factor.
Yeah, and they sell each other power already right now. But my understanding is that there's currently 38 system operators that manage the electricity distribution in these different states, and they feel like it would be more efficient if just one of these organizations managed all of the power distribution. And so that is what California has proposed, is that the California system operator expand and become a regional system operator that manage all of these power grids.
And so there are studies pointing to some big benefits environmentally, especially to California, but maybe not a lot of information on how states like Utah might benefit right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, PacifiCorps did a study that looked at all of its footprint, which would include Utah, and found, you know, upwards of $200 million in benefits for them. California just this week released their studies that were conducted by the ISO and found billions of dollars in savings for them. But they only looked at California. They did look western-wide at emissions. You know, the idea is that this would promote renewable energy more and would therefore cut reliance on fossil fuels and would improve or decrease emissions of fossil fuel, you know, carbon, PM2.5 of concern to Utah. And what they found was that probably in the short term, emissions would increase because the market would be bigger. So more people would be buying, say, coal-generated power from Utah initially. But then they think down the road, they're hoping that free market forces will put those coal plants more or less out of business and replace them with renewable energy.
Okay, so a sort of leveling out that would that would allow that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But you mentioned this, that Utah could see an actual increase in carbon emissions in the first few years, and that would come from our coal-fired power plants.
That's what California has projected.
Okay, so what are Utah lawmakers saying about this, or what action did they take on Wednesday?
So during the hearing, there was a motion made to open a bill file that would allow Utah's legislature to weigh in on this. Currently, what's happened is the ISO has said, "Hey, Rocky Mountain Power, you want in on this deal." And Rocky Mountain Power is the one that will decide whether it wants to get in. If Rocky Mountain Power decides it wants it in, it will then have to take a proposal to the Public Service Commission in Utah and get their approval. But right now, unless the law changes, that's it. Utah lawmakers don't necessarily have a say unless they write a law that says you can't join this operation unless we say so. And so that was the motion that was made. The vote got a little mixed up, and so just for technical reasons, it's not clear whether that bill file is real yet.
Okay.
But their intent was clear. They want to make this bill.
They want to make a bill that would say you need our permission, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. And that's but there was, I guess, some opposition expressed during this hearing by some lawmakers saying, look, this is too much interference on our part. Is that right?
Not on that part. There was opposition to the ISO's proposal because there are concerns that Utah and other states that participate in this will not be allowed enough say over energy policy, that this will give California power to decide what happens with energy policy in Utah, which this is Utah politically. That's not a popular thing.
Right.
So that is the major concern. There were some concerns raised about the emissions increase, about the fact that there may not be benefits to Utah because PacifiCorp's study only looked at savings. It didn't look at the cost of joining this grid,
right,
which there could be some, for technical reasons, averaging of the prices between the different states involved. California's power rates are a lot higher because of different factors than Utah's. And the concern is that if you average those, Utah's will go up.
In terms of rates. Okay. You know, you mentioned the concern that the California would have too much power, or that this board, this entity would have too much power over how the grid is operated. It would, I'm going to just sort of speculate here for a second, but wouldn't it make sense that you would have to have sort of a central operator to manage this, as opposed to it being done, every decision having to be done kind of in real time, as you said, electricity having to be, you know, dealt with as it, you know, as it's produced?
That is what is done now.
Okay.
There is currently what they call the energy imbalance market, in which PacifiCorp participates with the ISO. So that is actually, they are working in real time to sell power now. It has been argued that it would be more efficient to have one person managing it. During the hearing, the metaphor made was it's like trying to have 38 people drive the same bus. Another metaphor that was made was that it's 38 people driving down the freeway and asking some to carpool. So different perspectives on the issue.
Absolutely. And it'll be interesting to see what comes of it, I guess, during the next legislative session, assuming this bill file is real.
Yes.
Okay. Well, Emma Penrod, on the Environment Beat, also, you reported this week on a new Environmental Protection Agency study, kind of adding to results from other studies looking at hazardous air along the Wasatch Front. But this is different than particulate pollution or our sort of wintertime inversions. Tell us about this study and what it found.
Well, there were actually two studies that kind of got mashed into one article. Okay. But the new one actually is a state study that has been done. The EPA has studied air toxics in Utah, but not in the in the detail the state wanted.
Okay.
So the state actually did a more detailed study to try to understand in detail what's happening on the Wasatch Front. We only had one monitoring station on the Wasatch Front. They wanted to look at several to see if that one monitoring station is representative of the entire area. And so what's going on here? You mentioned these are different pollutants. The EPA kind of puts air pollutants into two categories. One there that is called criteria pollutants. That's your PM2.5. That's our inversion particulate stuff. Ozone, which has been an issue this summer. Things like that. Those you can think of as like really common widespread pollutants, and they're
sure.
They're bad. They don't do any favors for anyone's health.
Right.
But they're common pollutants. Now there's this other category called hazardous air pollutants. These are, I guess you could say, exotic pollutants or novelty pollutants. They're less common. You find them in small concentrations in small areas, but they are still also toxic. Just the fact that they're called toxic or hazardous air pollutants, people immediately go, oh. It doesn't necessarily mean they're any worse. It's just the name they were given. The difference is they're not as common.
And what are we talking about? What kinds of, in your reporting, I saw formaldehyde among them.
Mm-hmm.
What is the danger of it? And where does it come from?
Yeah, the ones that formaldehyde was one that they identified in Utah, specifically on the Wasatch Front, as a problem. A lot of these are like formaldehyde. They're called volatile organic compounds,
sure.
So they're chemicals. Others are heavy metals. Lead is another issue that came up. So this is really a broad spectrum of things that can get into the air. But each one kind of has a specific consequence. Formaldehyde can cause cancer. It's believed to cause cancer. It also is a pulmonary irritant, so it causes swelling in your pulmonary system and in your respiratory system.
Right.
Could trigger an asthma attack. That swelling is over time thought to cause damage that may lead to heart issues down the road. There's other things like one that we're improving on is benzene.
Mm-hmm.
Has neurological problems, behavioral problems, affects reproduction and fetal development. Lead, that's another neurological one. It's delays brain development.
Okay, so state regulators they've actually been, I know, applauded for the way that they carried out the study by
mm-hmm.
a number of groups saying this is getting to the bottom of a problem, trying to figure it out. Now that they've identified, I guess, the fact that there are some of these toxins, air toxins, what comes next?
Well, the study only looked at what's here and where it's at. Like I said, they had this one monitoring station already in Bountiful that was reporting things like high levels of formaldehyde. They wanted to see if that was across because these, are novel little things that can occur on a local basis. They wanted to see if all of the Wasatch Front has these problems or if they're just in Bountiful.
Mm-hmm.
So they picked a couple of other sites and cross-referenced them and found that formaldehyde, for example, is actually all over the Wasatch Front.
Hmm.
Other things like there was a methylene chloride only in Bountiful.
Right, and that was sort of a mystery that was interesting. It
mm-hmm.
spiked over a short period of time, and it had regulators thinking that it was coming from a very specific
mm-hmm.
source, but they don't know what that is, right?
Yeah, that's the case so far with all of these. They haven't identified where any of these issues are specifically coming from. They have hunches on a couple because of where they can commonly come from. But that is the next step, as you were asking. They've got to find out where it's coming from before they can do anything about it.
And so there's been calls for greater monitoring of air quality, more monitoring stations across
mm-hmm.
the Wasatch Front, I guess, as a result of this new information coming in.
Yeah, the monitoring thing, that is that's an ongoing thing that was called for in the legislative session. The Division of Air Quality asked for additional funding. They want to install more monitors, both on the Wasatch Front and outside the Wasatch Front elsewhere in Utah. But they also need to upgrade their systems and replace some of their old technology that they have. They have some old sensors, some old monitors that are breaking. People may have noticed if they frequent the division's website to check the air levels, sometimes they go down and there's no reports. They're running out of the ability to fix those because they're running out of spare parts and things. So they requested the monies. They only got part of what they asked for. So they expect to continue to see problems.
And they also got, if I'm not mistaken, this last legislative session, a sort of side amount of money, which was the ability for residents to voluntarily contribute to their... is this right? You know, that you in your taxes can give money to the Department of Environmental Quality.
Yeah, there was a fund created where if you would like to pay extra taxes, you can, through your taxes, give money to an air quality fund that would maybe benefit this issue.
A little bit different than state funding, than actual state funding coming through. Okay. Well, some interesting environment reporting there from Emma Penrod. Listeners, we'd love to get your thoughts on these stories or anything else in the local news. Call us up at 801-355-TALK. You can also comment at sltrib.com. Just follow the Behind the Headlines link on the Salt Lake Tribune's homepage. We're going to have to take another quick break, but we will return in a moment. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm KCPW producer Roger McDonough, joined in studio this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Lee Davidson, Christopher Smart, and Emma Penrod for a review of this past week's news. Christopher Smart, you have been waiting very patiently here on the City Beat this week. You tackled a couple of interesting stories, one being the story of accusations against Salt Lake City's fire chief. What's the story here?
Well, this story surrounds Fire Captain Martha Ellis, who was recently demoted. She was a battalion chief, and she's recently demoted to captain. And she filed a notice of claim with Salt Lake City, which is sort of a precursor to a lawsuit. And in that notice of claim, she alleged that there is sexual harassment and sexual discrimination at the fire department. But she also laid out a number of other accusations, including fraud, including top fire brass making money while they were on the city's dime, and other irregularities like that. Now,
This was sort of her the initial accusations that she made internally, right? I mean, she said this to her superiors at the fire department.
Well, so she has been making complaints internally since 2012, but this is a written notice of claim to the city administration of Jackie Biskupski saying, okay, here are my grievances. You know, I demand that you give me back my old rank, and I demand that you do all these things. If you don't, I'm going to sue. And so this week we learned that that this has been ongoing for a while, and that the city's human resources department has actually had these allegations made. I don't know the pejorative here for a female dog. I don't know if we can use that on the air.
I don't think so.
I'm getting the ixnay. Okay. So she had complained about this sort of language being commonly used in the department, and at least three or four others have filed complaints against Chief Brian Dale, saying that he used that language to describe female firefighters. Hmm. The Human Resources Department did not find that conclusively that that was the case. But this week we heard and have in our possession recordings where a male voice is using this language to describe several female firefighters. And the attorney for Martha Ellis says that voice is that of Chief Brian Dale. Brian Dale has announced that he will retire in October. And one thing that I want to mention here is that because there's this threat of litigation, the city will not allow Brian Dale or anyone else to answer these allegations. So we've just got one side of the story here, okay?
Okay. No, it's definitely worth and important to note. You know, you said that he announced that he, this is the fire chief said that he announced that he is retiring. Is that, You know, is there any, I don't know, is there any commentary on whether or not that has to do with this potential lawsuit?
The mayor's office says there's no quid pro quo. But remember, Brian Dale has been chief only about a year, actually a little over a year. And so it seems unusual that he would retire so soon, but in October he will have been with the department 30 years, and so he's saying that's what he's doing. The city says it has nothing to do with these allegations.
The now mayor, Jackie Biskupski, who in her campaign leading up to mayor, she made fighting sexual harassment one of a number of points that she said that she was going to do because of accusations inside of the Salt Lake City Police Department. What does the mayor's office have to say about these allegations? Are they allowed to speak about it?
They won't.
Okay.
But I will say this. When former Mayor Ralph Becker fired Chief Chris Burbank— last summer, it sent a real ripple through this community and looked to be a turning point in the election because Burbank was popular. Folks didn't think he was treated fairly when he got fired like that. It was over sexual harassment in the police department that was substantiated by a deputy chief who was allowed to stay on administrative leave until he got his 20 years and then could retire. Jackie Biskupski, the candidate, ran this up the flagpole, and she really made it a big part of her campaign that she would not stand for sexual harassment, sexual discrimination in the city. One of the interesting aspects of this is that then Battalion Chief Martha Ellis in January went to Mayor Biskupski and laid this all out. The mayor handed it to the new Human Resources Department, who sort of, shall we say, punted. And so, you know, nothing has been done. However, I will say this, that a spokesperson for the mayor said that the mayor is instituting new programs within the department aimed at, you know, reducing or eliminating sexual harassment. But the allegations coming from Martha Ellis include that this is part of the culture.
Right. Her lawyer says that there is a culture of sexism at the fire department in Salt Lake City and that there's, you know, evidence for that. And these recordings are evidence of that. Again, we only have sort of the one side of the story because the other side is not commenting on this. You mentioned that there's a notice of claim. Will this become a lawsuit? Do we know that yet?
Well, OK. So she filed the claim January 5th or 6th. The city has 60 days to respond. They don't have to respond. But after 60 days, Martha Ellis can file suit in state court. Now, that's what they said they're going to do. We'll have to wait and see if they do it. It's 60 days from June 5th. So, you know, that's coming up quickly.
And then maybe we'll have additional information about this after that.
Well, if it plays out in court, we will, because the city will have to answer.
Okay, well, Christopher Smart, covering an interesting story there. Another story that you reported on this week it had to do with a protest. I almost saved this for my underplayed story of the week, but a protest that went on outside of City Hall in Park City. Residents expressing their displeasure with what?
Vail Resorts Incorporated out of Colorado wants to trademark the name Park City. Vail Resorts now operates what used to be called the Canyons and what is still called Park City Mountain Resort. It combined them into one resort, and it wants to call that resort Park City. Residents of Park City don't like that idea at all. They say that Park City is a community, not a ski resort. They say that the ski resort is, you know, a big part of the economy, but they don't want their identity to be swallowed up by this large corporation. So this, the history goes back a ways when Park City originally had a lease, Park City Mountain Resort originally had a lease with United Park City Mines in 1973 to be renewed every 20 years. In the interim, Talisker Corp gobbled up United Park City Mines. Talisker Corp also got the canyons. Talisker Corp leased the canyons to Vail, and Park City Mountain Resort previous owners forgot to renew the lease in 2013, and so Vail took them to court and then got the other resort, the both. So now Vail is the new sheriff in town, and they are huge. And so the folks in Park City, the mayor and the city council said, we're worried. Vail said, don't worry. Anybody using the Park City name, we won't harm you. The city took a contract to them, said, here, sign this, and then we won't have problems with the trademark. Vail said, no, we won't sign it. And so that brings us up where we are today, where the trademark application is in.
Okay.
And now there's this period. It's been extended by 60 days where folks can protest. And so the protesters earlier this week were really unhappy and disgruntled that this outfit, this big corporation that said they were going to be a good community partner, is stealing their identity.
Will the protests have an effect on the trademark application itself? I mean, will that be considered by those considering that application?
One thing is that the protest is having an impact on the mayor and the council, who originally wanted to break bread with Vail and have everybody live happily ever after. Now the mayor and city councilors were standing with our residents. They have a petition with 2,300 signatures or more against, and all of those people in that petition can be forwarded to the federal government Office of Patents and Trademarks, and they will take that into consideration in terms of, you know, should Vail own the name Park City.
All right. Well, what town are you from? I'm from Park City, a wholly owned subsidiary of the. But it's a fascinating story, and there's a lot of coverage on it and other stories at sltrib.com. Christopher Smart, thank you very much for the reporting. The hour has gone by quickly, and we've got to turn to our final segment, the underplayed story of the week. And Chris Smart, I think I'll stick with you. Any underplayed stories for this week?
Well, this is not a humorous story, but Jackie Biskupski, the mayor of Salt Lake City, announced earlier this week that by 2013, the entire city would be operated on 100% renewable energy. And so that's a huge step forward. It's a partnership with Rocky Mountain Power. Rocky Mountain Power says right now its power sources are 30% renewables. They expect that to go up in the future.
Enough to cover the full city?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and so there's the other part of this is that Jackie and the city council are saying by 2040 Salt Lake City will reduce its greenhouse emissions by 80%.
Wow.
That's community-wide.
Wow. Fascinating underplayed story there, a commitment from Salt Lake City. How about yourself, Emma Penrod, underplayed story of the week?
I guess mine's not really humorous either. I didn't know they were supposed to be
humorous. No, it's okay. They don't have to be.
So, not necessarily underplayed, maybe just because there's been bigger stories, but not necessarily an unimportant story. There is an algal bloom down at Utah Lake. Again, this lake has been having trouble with algal blooms the last couple of years. These are situations you get certain kinds of pollutants in the water, you raise the temperature a little bit of the water, and these algae just explode in growth. So I understand there's something like a mile-long bloom that has been down there. It's visible from the air. It's visible from satellites.
And threatening to animals and people.
And yes, and potentially toxic. Some of these algae create chemical compounds as a sort of defense, a natural defense mechanism that can be extremely harmful and even fatal if consumed to humans and other animals. So posted warnings down there telling people not to swim in the lake, not to drink the lake water. Shouldn't drink the lake water anyway, but
well,
there you go.
And the dogs can't read, though, so I don't know
this
what they're going to
do.
How about yourself, Lee Davidson, underplayed story of the week?
Oh, we're a humorless bunch today. But a lot of people say they don't vote because they don't think their one vote counts. But this week there was a race that we got the final vote count in. And by 8 votes, State Representative Mel Brown of Colville lost. He's the longest-serving House member currently, 24 years total, and he's a former House member, and was defeated by Morgan County Commission Chairman Logan Wild. So 8 votes. There's still a recount pending, but it shows that your vote can count.
Voting matters. Voting makes a difference. For my part, I'm going to go – thanks, by the way, Lee Davidson. My part, Seabear's Ogden Fish House, where the – I'm going to go comedy, by the way, where the servers wear Scottish kilts and also carry sidearms, open carrying while they work, apparently demonstrating their Second Amendment rights, and customers aren't scared off by the guns. Emma Penrod, Christopher Smart, Lee Davidson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thank you very much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks, Roger.
Thank you.
That's it for this edition of Behind the Headlines, a production of KCPW Radio, Utah Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks to Jesse Ellis at KCPW, Tom Williams, and Connor Rivers at UPR, and the Tribune's Emily Means. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in this morning, and have a pleasant weekend.